Welcome to Season 10 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm. We manage approximately $110 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional and retail investors. That capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. Each week, I sit down with key relationships to, partners of, and friends of the firm to learn from their experience, ask how that experience shapes their current roles, and give insights into HPS and how we operate. So with that, let's bring in our guest. Our guest this week is a managing director in HPS's London office focused on direct lending and special situations investing. After a BA and an MPhil at Oxford and Cambridge, respectively, he started his career at Bain Capital in London in their Sankaty Advisors business focused on credit investing. After 7 years there, we were able to convince him to join HPS in 2016. And since then, he's been instrumental in leading a broad variety of HPS transactions across senior, junior, and special situations investing. I thoroughly enjoy the honor of working with this gent, and I'm happy to have him on with us today. So without any further ado, I'm thrilled to welcome in this week's HPS Cast guest, our very own Chris Stanton. Chris, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much.
All right, Chris, let's start from the start. Where'd you grow up? Where are you from originally?
I grew up in a small town in Yorkshire called Howden, 4,000 or 5,000 people. Not many people know it, but actually has a very long history going back 1,000 plus years.
I love it. Now, tell me then how we got from there to Oxford. You attended Merton College at Oxford. Tell me about that path.
So I think at some point when I was maybe 11 or 12, I seem to remember watching a movie and liking the idea of getting to Oxford or Cambridge. So I'd kind of set myself on this path of, you know, when I get to 18, I would like to go to Oxbridge. It was a bit of a singular focus for those years, but it was helpful as a driver. And I actually remember when I was 17, like passing my driving test on the Friday and getting my Oxford offer on the Saturday.
Greatest weekend of your life.
That was a pretty big weekend.
All right. So then what did you study undergrad?
I did geography undergrad, which is pretty atypical for someone, I think, who's in finance. You know, I did think about studying economics or finance, but I actually came to the view that, you know, I wanted to study something that I really enjoyed and ideally do well at something I enjoyed. And the thing I particularly liked about geography was the interdisciplinary nature and also the interplay between human world and physical world. There's a bit of a qualitative element as well as a quantitative element.
Yeah. I'm also happy to report as a native son of North Carolina that legend Michael Jordan's undergraduate college major, true story, was geography. So you're in good company. You went on to then get your MPhil at Robinson College in Cambridge. What was the draw of that coursework?
So I think by the time I'd finished undergrad, I wasn't necessarily quite ready to leave university. So I thought, okay, let me take the opportunity to do a one-year master's. In my master's, I chose to do development studies, which actually was a pretty healthy mix of some of the topics I picked up whilst doing my geography undergrad. Plus, there was a more finance element to it. How do, you know, capital markets develop in emerging countries was one course that I particularly enjoyed. And that course was at Cambridge as opposed to Oxford. But I think at the end of that course, when my professors figured out I was going to go into finance, I think they were a bit horrified. I think they were expecting me maybe go to the IMF or the World Bank. They were like, hang on a second, how does this work?
Well, now tell me about that. What was the draw? Like, why did you make the decision at that point? We'll talk about Sankaty in a bit, but just the finance period. Why was that important to you?
During my time in my undergrad in Oxford, you know, I decided that it was important to do an internship, do some work experience. But I actually found someone that had been to Cambridge, and that person was working at Lehman Brothers in markets. So in the summer of my first year, I went and did a couple of weeks interning with him on the trading floor. Piqued my interest. And that was a mixture of equities plus equity research. And I kind of liked the equity research a bit more than the trading. Anyway, the following summer, I managed to get a full internship. And during that internship, I actually did a mixture of equity derivatives and commodities. But at the end, I figured out that, you know, I didn't love the idea of staring at a screen all day long. And I wanted to go kind of more under the surface of companies, understand the drivers.
It's a different skill set. You know, different people are suited for different places.
Exactly. So I then decided to go to the other extreme. I was fortunate enough to get an offer for Lehman Brothers. That offer actually had a start date for the day they went bankrupt in 2008. I had turned down that offer and gone to the other extreme, which was getting an offer from the Boston Consulting Group. So I went from trading floor to proper bottoms up company analysis. I think it was at that point, around that time period, I decided, okay, I want to do a postgrad, do 4 years as opposed to 3 years. And in that intervening period, I actually interned at Bain.
Got it.
So they offered a summer analyst program. And I felt, having done the internship at Bain, that was actually a great mix of business analysis, financial analysis, legal analysis. And so in terms of the decision of going, you know, quote unquote, into finance, it was a little bit of, I wouldn't say trial and error, because I don't think any...
How about trial? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. A trial. A trial, yeah. Exactly.
And it is interesting, Chris, you're a very thoughtful investor. And I think that the interdisciplinary way you think about geography and what appealed to you of that, it's the same thing. Like there's a lot of finance that can be quite narrow and focused. Our job done well, you have to, I think, be broad in what you do. I'm not surprised that that had an appeal to you, given your background. Okay, so you end up at Bain Capital. Now, for those less familiar, Bain Capital is obviously a massive private equity firm. Tell us about their Sankey advisory business, in particular in sort of 2009, like early days in credit there. What was that business?
So I think around the time I joined, I think the business was something on the line. It was 25 to 30 billion of AUM. So it was a pretty sizable chunk of the business. Back then it was known as Sankey Advisors. Today it's known as Bain Capital Credit. And I think the juxtaposition of what I was looking at then to when I actually joined the firm in 2009 was stark. I mean, I think starting my career in 2009 was, sometimes I think it was a good thing because it makes me focus a lot on downside protection. Think about, I wouldn't say worst case scenarios, but certainly it gives you a good imagination in regards to the downside case. High quality loan issuers trading at kind of in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And then me being smart about, you know, 1 or 2 points in retrospect seems silly. That was a great way to start my career. And
listen, we always say this on the podcast. I am such a firm believer that you're shaped by the economic environment that you start your career in. And any of us who spent time during these crises, you know, you're always jumping at shadows. You're looking at contagion risk. Like you get formed by those first jobs. Let's be precise. What were you actually doing? Like what was the job at Bain and how did you spend your time?
When I started my career at Bain, I was predominantly focused on liquid credit, and within that, the more stressed and distressed names.
Yep.
In the early years of my career, I saw names go down by 40 points in a day. Then other investments we missed by 1 point, which ended up being a 2x money.
Yeah.
Lots of lessons were learned in those first couple of years. But actually, my first year, rather than just buying a particular loan at 60 with a view of a restructuring coming up or a pull to par, some of the things we do was actually kind of revolving names and CLOs. So doing kind of switches.
Yeah.
So in that era, I kind of felt like I honed a better sense of not just absolute value, but also relative value. But when I joined Bain, I knew really nothing. I didn't really know what EBITDA was. But luckily, I had a great set of people to learn from. And there's a lot of ex-Bain & Co. consultants there who are able to help me kind of get up to speed on how to take a view on businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's get HPS into the picture here. Tell us about the transaction where you met Scott French and first got introduced to the firm.
Yep, so it's actually around a decade ago now. So whilst I was at Bain, I guess, you know, my career there was really in two main components. The first component was more on the liquid side, doing kind of a secondary stress and distress. And the second part of my career there was helping to start the non-performing loan and real estate business, which was more portfolio-based. One of the kind of later deals I did on the secondary stress and distress side was getting involved in the predecessor to Ardonna, the feature of a few of our HPS strategic investment partners funds. We were invested both in the kind of senior secured bonds of the predecessor to Ardonna, as well as the unsecured bonds. And Scott French was, I guess, looking after that position for HPS at the same time I was looking after the position for Bain. So we met in the late summer, autumn of 2014. And over the next 6 months, Scott and I spent a long time together. It was a great way to get to know Scott, but also get to know HPS as a firm. And, you know, there was quite a few twists and turns in those negotiations to get to the reorganization of Ardonna's predecessor to, I guess, help lay the foundations for what the company is today.
So tell us then, you get through that transaction, you spend time, you're sort of in the trenches together. How did things move from, hey, this guy, Chris, is talented to, okay, let's talk about getting you on our side and talk to me also about the appeal of HPS for you for then?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, spending those kind of circa 6 months with Scott, I soon figured out he was a very, very hard negotiator. But, you know, a great strategic thinker at the same time as being in all the details. But also he is very persistent and persuasive. So I think the Towergate deal, as Ardonna's predecessor was called, was ultimately consummated by a scheme of arrangement. And that closed in early 2015. And I think the day after that scheme of arrangement closed, Scott called me and said, it would be great in future negotiations if you were on our side of the table as opposed to that side of the table. I'd said, yeah, I'm not really sure that works. And, you know, Bain looks quite attractive and I have a good runway here and there's no pushback just for me to leave. But in the subsequent kind of year and a half, Scott remained close. And then I was introduced to Mike Patterson, Scott Kapnick, and I eventually made the move in kind of the mid to late of 2016.
Yeah. So tell us about that. How big was the HPS London office when you joined? Do you remember?
I think now we are 100 plus people. I think back then it was a fraction of that number.
Yeah.
But in terms of the draws to HPS, so I think from Bain, there was no real, you know, push factors per se. But as the years went by, I felt kind of the market in Europe, not necessarily just Bain, was kind of bifurcated between regular way direct lending, kind of pure play sponsor lending. And the other extreme, you had distressed, you know, secondary distressed, non-performing loans. There was not that much going on in people's minds in the middle. But I actually thought that's where some of the most interesting deals were. And in the conversations with HPS, I felt actually there was a big opportunity for someone to take that skill set from kind of handling complex transactions in the distressed world, the non-performing world, and apply it on a private credit platform.
Yeah.
And actually go after those deals that are quote unquote in the middle between regular way direct lending and your heavier distressed transactions.
You lead a lot of our more bespoke, complicated financings, both in more senior, more junior. You know, you've got a broad remit within the European environment there. Talk to me about that evolution of the distress market generally. What do you do? Like, give us examples of the kind of stuff that happens in the direct lending and junior capital investing business out of London.
So in the time period I was doing more secondary investing between 2009 to say 2013, that was your kind of classic old school distress market. You know, there was a lot of bank sellers. Generally, everything had a pretty tight security package. Everything had a covenant. And the banks were selling large blocks. If you were a fund buying, you could potentially buy, you know, 26% or 34% straight off the bat. I did a piece of work which was comparing how would the distressed landscape evolve in Europe from kind of 2009 to say 2013, where it was a very loan-heavy environment, to I would say 2015, 2016, and now where it's a more bond-heavy environment. But when I say bond heavy, I don't just mean pure high yield. I also mean leveraged loans, which are starting to look a lot like bonds in terms of no covenants and weakened security packages. And when I was working, doing this piece of work, it really dawned on me that it's a very, very different distressed environment. Because if you're buying a high yield bond or you're buying a cov-lite security loose term loan, if something goes wrong, there's no early trigger events. You know, the trigger will be a maturity or liquidity need, i.e. dollar prices are probably going to go pretty low. There's ways for people to drop collateral out of your package and put incremental debt in the system or take out dividends or otherwise known as RPs. Also, in a more bond format, it's harder to get information. You know, if you were buying into a bank syndicate, you could go immediately meet the management. You know, there was sometimes monthly meetings the banks had actually negotiated before you even got involved in something that was stressed. So you put it all together in terms of fragmented holder bases, poor information, no covenants, loose collateral package. I kind of figured out in the 2015-16 time period, actually, you know, the game has changed quite a lot. There's not going to be the same secondary distress cycle and buying opportunity there was before. And that's when I guess my mind was turning to kind of those quote unquote deals in the middle between the regular way direct lending sphere and the distress sphere. Is there ways to kind of, to some extent, use the looseness in the loan and bond documentation to actually put new capital into those situations?
We say this all the time. It's unequivocally a worse environment if you're a public markets only investor today. It's never been harder to understand sort of how you can be disadvantaged given weak documentation. But there is an inverse to that. The corollary is it's never been better as a borrower. If you need capital, you can raise it in a downside protected manner to the new lender in a way that was unimaginable 10, 15 years ago. And the confluence and sort of, you correctly say, what was distressed in private credit, which were actually quite separate 15 to 20 years ago, there's a massive convergence there now in the middle. Tell us about an example of that kind of stuff that you've been doing.
I guess kind of the first kernel of the idea when I joined was like, okay, well, you know, all these high yield bonds, to some extent leveraged loans, have these super senior baskets. So, you know, if a company needs liquidity, is there a way for us to fill that super senior basket, which is super priority or in essence ahead of the first lien, to plug a liquidity gap, I guess being the primary use of proceeds? And we did that a couple of times pre-COVID, but clearly during the COVID years, we were able to do some of those otherwise known as basket fill investments. But I think there's a few more derivations of just the pure, you know, super senior basket bill. In some cases, you have the ability to kind of add more pari debt. I've not done much of the pari raises. It's harder to get a bespoke security package. Our usual way of doing business is we want to speak for the majority of the tranche, or we want to speak for the all of the tranche. We want to drive the documentation. If you're doing a pari piece, it's much harder to do that. So if one iteration is super senior basket fill, that's attractive. The pari add-on pari passu with an existing tranche harder. But then the further derivations are, can you drop down assets into an unrestricted subsidiary and finance that? But I guess in all these situations, HPS is coming in general as a third-party capital provider. We want to be a problem solver, and we want to be a friend to the situation. So it may be the case that from a borrower's perspective, they're having a hard time dealing with certain of their creditors and they can't raise the money they need quick enough. We're able to obviously help them get the liquidity they need by filling whatever basket may be available. And that is actually one of the most enjoyable parts of the job, is figuring out what is an issue that a company has and what is a creative way that we can fix it.
It's a job where you get to be a solutions provider that can provide a win-win, and providing a solution to a company is super interesting.
And also the opportunity set, from when I first joined, the kernel of the idea was kind of new money into an existing capital structure, super senior or structurally senior or in a kind of unrestricted sub drop-down. I think that evolved over time. And actually kind of some of the other interesting transactions we've looked at are just larger and with complexity or perceived complexity. A super senior basket fill will be small because, yes, these bond and loan documents are loose, but they're not crazy loose to allow multi-hundred million of super senior to come in typically. Maybe it's 100 million, 150 million, 75 million. After kind of 1-2 years, the idea evolved to actually, are there some more stressed senior refinancings we can do where you're taking out the whole capital structure? In many cases in Europe, you have a multi-hundred million cap stack, which is maybe owned by a non-sponsor, so family, entrepreneur, or public company. Maybe it's in a sector which has had some difficulty in the past. Maybe it's a post-restructured business. It doesn't need to be new money into a distress situation. Actually, it could be a situation that's just large with complexity or perceived complexity, which doesn't fit into one of those two buckets we discussed earlier.
Yeah.
Your regular way sponsor LBO or your hardcore distress.
Well, Chris, so what we've seen in the last 18 months, obviously, post the rate move, you know, for the first time since literally the beginnings of your career, rates are something other than zero, right? Base rates at 5 to 5.5% obviously has profound impacts on what's happened in the markets. You've always been thoughtful about trends and what's coming. What gets you excited about the future in the European market? Like, what do you look at right now and say, okay, here's what I'm excited about over the next 3 to 5 years?
So I think clearly private credit has developed a lot in the European market, like it has in the US market. Grown a lot, but also become more nuanced. I still think the European private credit market has one sphere, which is frankly pretty competitive, mid-market LBO sponsor lending, 150 million to 250 million tranche sizes, where people are happy to, I guess, do small club syndicates. I think in that particular area, you have a good chance of being underpriced and understructured. You don't want to be gridded, as we call it. I put in an Excel grid against everyone else to the nth degree. However, in Europe, I think outside of that sphere, there's two axes where we try to differentiate ourselves. One is scale. So if you're taking kind of 500 million, a billion, 1.5 billion hold sizes, there are very, very, very few players who can, I guess, tackle that size, you know, HPS being one. Then the other axis is complexity. And we've touched on some of these themes already. So within Europe, that kind of non-LBO and particularly kind of non-mid-market space, you're still finding a lot of interesting things to do. And if we look at what's going on in the public markets, and there's always a bit of an intersection between the public and private worlds, often we run screens of loans and bonds actually to generate kind of ideas for our private credit business. I think the maturity wall was kind of pretty heavily discussed a year ago. And I was discussing a maturity wall in 2010 when I was back at Bain. I think now the maturity wall has a bit more of a math issue in terms of, well, rates are higher, so some cap stacks are going to break. Even if confidence returns, new debt is issued, well, you still have higher rates.
Let me just stop for a second for people less familiar. Maturity wall, there's a bunch of debt that's coming due over the next couple of years. People have warned about that since the global financial crisis, and it's never really arisen as a problem because if rates are zero, you can almost always find somebody who's going to refinance that debt. The math problem that Chris is alluding to is that with the rates move, suddenly your borrowing costs in many cases double or triple, depending on what your spread was. And so, you know, literally just mathematically, you are carrying too much debt at current rates to be able to service it. And that creates opportunities because people need more complicated bespoke financings in that world.
So I think if you look at what's been happening on the leveraged loan side in Europe, a lot of work has been done to address the leveraged loan maturity wall. I think if you look at the high yield side, you know, one way to look at it is the total amount of debt coming due in the near term. I think less work has been done towards that in terms of tackling the nearer term maturities. But actually, when you double click and look at some of the specific issuers, we are currently looking at multiple high yield issuers in Europe who are looking to tackle problems. And that might be taking out near-term maturities. On some bond structures, you have multiple staggered maturities. So maybe they need to take out short-term maturities with a private term loan, either most likely filling a super senior or other basket that's available. Alternatively, on some of those high-yield structures, there's just purely a liquidity problem.
You talked about if you're a sponsor and you want to raise a couple hundred million dollar direct loan into a new LBO, there are quite literally dozens of firms who can give it to you. And if you need a scale transaction where there's some complexity to it that maybe is non-sponsor, there's less than a handful. One of the things that I think, you know, we sort of pride ourselves on as an institution is just trying to be where the competitive set is much less. If we can minimize that competition, I think that can lead to more interesting situations. And that, I think, is where you sit, obviously, Chris, in what you do. Maybe let me pivot to one last question about the European environment. We have colleagues on the ground in the continent in Europe, but our biggest office in Europe is obviously in London. How do you think philosophically about lending into various countries across Europe?
So I think clearly one of the priorities when we're looking at deals is, you know, how do you plan for a scenario where something doesn't go well? What does that downside case look like? And unlike many others, our deals generally have covenants. So there will be an early trigger if something goes awry. And what does that actually mean? So where is your asset security? Where is your share pledge? You know, there are certain jurisdictions in Europe, particularly in the south of the continent, where it is going to be very hard to do, I guess, a non-consensual recut of the cap stack. In the northern part of the continent, actually, it's more straightforward to do a non-consensual. I think that's one of the fundamentals of doing any credit investment is being able to catch it on the downside and also control your destiny. So at HVS, we generally think it's important to ideally speak for all the tranche or a majority of the tranche, write the document yourself from first principles, and have the covenant and security package to be able to act if the deal goes awry.
Got it. Super interesting. Chris, it is always a great pleasure to catch up. Exciting things happening in the European environment. Appreciate you sharing your thoughtful views today. With that, I want to move to the last segment of the pod, something we like to call best ideas. We offer up something that's added value in our lives recently, best ideas, because it's our goal as investors to maximize exposure to those. Chris, you're our guest. I'm going to ask you to go first. What is your best idea this week?
So I'm a particular fan of spy thrillers. I think within kind of the genre, one of my favorite writers is John le Carré. I think there's been a lot of adaptations of John le Carré's work, but I think one of the less well-known adaptations is a UK miniseries called The Night Manager, which you can find on Netflix, originally produced by the BBC. And I would strongly recommend that. It's very captivating. I think it's actually maybe 6 or 7 episodes, done with a pretty high-profile cast, mainly a lot of British actors, including Hugh Laurie.
I'll heartily co-sign that. How about that? One of my favorite series I've watched recently, Hugh Laurie's amazing at it, playing very much against Tom Hiddleston's great. Elizabeth Debicki's great. It's a really fantastic show. So great one. All right. So my best idea, people know I like to be inspired by the guest of the week. As you heard earlier, Chris is a graduate of Oxford. And so I started there and started thinking about some of my favorite stories set there. And I thought back to a book recommended to me actually originally by my oldest sister, who was then a grad student at Nuffield College at Oxford. My best idea this week is a remarkable trilogy of fantasy novels by Philip Pullman called His Dark Materials, the first book, which was called The Golden Compass. The books came out in the mid-90s and have been made into both a movie and an HBO TV series, but I think in this case, the books really stand above the adaptations. The stories, full disclosure, they have magic in them. So if that's not your thing, I get it. But the fantasy, I think, serves the story really well here. The plot is about this young girl, Lyra, who lives at Oxford and gets swept up in this grand adventure with magic dust and polar bears and these overarching themes of the conflict between religion and science. The name, His Dark Materials, is actually taken from Milton's Paradise Lost, and Pullman has framed the story as a sort of a retelling and inversion of that story. So, in honor of an alum of Oxford, my best idea this week is the Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy, set initially, at least, in Chris's old stomping grounds. With that, it's time to wrap up for the week. Chris, thank you again for coming on. Grateful for a truly insightful conversation. I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Thanks again to our guest, Chris Stanton. Check out our show notes to learn more about Chris and his work at HPS. You can learn more about his best idea for the week, the BBC TV spy thriller, The Night Manager, in our show notes. There, you'll also find a link to read my best idea for the week, the fantasy novel trilogy, His Dark Materials, by Philip Pullman. This podcast was brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. The opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host, Colbert Cannon, and the guest of each episode, and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners.